Omaha Public Radio presents a special lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies and the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. We'll hear the second part of a presentation by Robbie Weissman, a survivor of the Buchenwald concentration camp, an educator, and past president of the Vancouver Center for Holocaust Remembrance and Education, and Leon Bass, World War II veteran and member of the 183rd Engineer Combat Battalion, a unit that liberated Buchenwald, and author of Good Enough, One Man's Memoir on the Price of the Dream. Their topic is A Story of Survival and Liberation. This special program is being presented in two parts. We heard Mr. Weissman's remarks yesterday. Today, we'll hear Dr. Bass. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 6, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, the Institute for Holocaust Education, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to reintroduce the program is Beth Selden Doton, Executive Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education.
Tonight will we hear from two individuals who beat all odds. Child survivor Robbie Weissman not only lost his family during the horrifying years of the Holocaust, but lost his childhood, his community, and the life as he knew it. Reuniting with one sister after the war, Robbie has survived to find a way to readjust and live after inconceivable years of Nazi terror. You will also hear from Leon Bass, who was a young African-American soldier during World War II, experienced his own bias and prejudice. You will hear firsthand what it was like for this young man to enter the Buchenwald concentration camp at the end of the war. Tonight, we will all bear witness to their testimonies and hear how it was possible for these two men to have met and encountered one another long after that chaotic time at Buchenwald. We will understand how they have helped each other to heal and move forward in their lives. We are honored to introduce Robbie Weissman and Leon Bass.
Good evening. It's a pleasure for me to be here and to be with Robbie. Somehow we reinforce each other. And every time I meet him, I feel invigorated. I feel as though I have something to say. So I'm here to speak with you today on this time of understanding. And I want to speak about three things. I want to speak about racism, yes, anti-Semitism, and the Holocaust. All three impacted on my life and caused me to think and feel as I do today. And so I want to share those thoughts and feelings with you this evening. It all began for me back in 1943 when I completed my high school education. But when I came out of high school, our country was fighting a war. So I did what so many young men were doing at the time. I volunteered to be part of the United States Army. But it was that decision that brought me face to face with institutional racism. It happened on the day that I was inducted into the service. I went down to the induction center in Philadelphia with some of my friends. They happened to be white. And when we got to the door of the induction center, there was a sergeant standing there. He took one look at me and he said, "Go this way." He looked at my friends and he told them to go this way. Now that was done because back in 1943, all of our armed forces, the entire military, was segregated. My country, our country, practiced and promoted institutional racism. And by doing that, my country was saying to me, "Leon, you're not good enough. No, you're not good enough to serve your country with white soldiers." So they separated me from my friends. I was sent down into the deep South for my basic training. My parents were born in South Carolina, but I never got too much information about how life was for them in when they were growing up. But when I got down into Georgia, I found out Georgia, Mississippi, Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, and in all these places, every one of them, the people living there, the people I'm going to protect, I took an oath, I'm going to protect and defend them all. But they were telling me I wasn't good enough. But I knew better. But I went into Macon, Georgia, on a hot summer day. I walked around that town. I wanted to see what Macon was all about. But I got thirsty. I see this public water fountain. I walk over to it. And I'm so naive. I walk over and I leaned over to drink and someone grabbed me and said, "Hold it, boy. You don't drink here." I was shocked at what he said, but then he pointed to the sign. And so my education began. I was on maneuvers. I was what they call war games down in Texas and Louisiana. And on this day, I was with the lieutenant, and he at lunch at the Luau, and he decided he wanted to eat lunch. So we drove into, I'm trying to remember the town now, to get lunch. But we drove up in front of the restaurant. He got out, walked over to me, and he said, "Private Bass, I'm going to meet you back here in just about 1 hour." He walked away. He walked into the restaurant. He left me standing on the sidewalk. Well, I was hungry, so when I saw this man passing by, I approached him and said, "Mister, can you tell me where I might get something to eat?" And he looked at me, and that voice of his is, "Boy, you can get something in this restaurant, but you're going to have to go up the alley, around the back, knock on the door. And when they come, give them your money and your order, and they'll bring you the food. And you could find a place like back there where you might sit down and eat." Again, I was being told that I wasn't good enough to eat in a restaurant. In Mississippi, good old Mississippi, I'll never forget it. I got aboard the bus. I saw the sign. My education is spreading now. The sign said colored must be seated at the back of the bus. Well, I go to the back of the bus. Well, when I get back there, I discover all of the seats in that section were already filled. And so on that day, my friends, and I kid you not, on that day I stood up for more than 100 miles, and I looked at empty seats in the front of that bus that I was not permitted to occupy. And there I stood, dressed in the uniform of my country. I'm pledged to do all I can to keep these people safe in this country. But I wasn't good enough. Oh, what a damnable experience to have when you're 18 years of age and you volunteered to serve your country. Well, my friends, there was very little I could do about that situation in 1943 except to keep the pain that comes with rejection, to keep it down here inside. But finally, the day came for my unit, the 183rd Engineer Combat Battalion, to have overseas duty. So we left from Boston. We crossed the Atlantic Ocean to England. We stayed in England 2 or 3 months getting our equipment together. And then the day came for us to leave, to go over into the continent. So we went across the English Channel to Le Havre, France. And we drove our vehicles up through France. We parked them alongside the road outside of a small town. You see, we had to wait for orders. Orders that would tell us what our responsibility was going to be in the war. This was 1944. It was in December. The temperatures were well below zero. Snow was everywhere. But we waited. We waited. And finally, orders came down and said that our battalion would be attached to the Third Army under the leadership of General George Patton. Oh, but just at that time, things began to happen. Things which we knew nothing about. The enemy, in one last desperate attempt to try to win the war, that enemy had been searching, probing. They were looking for the weak spot, one weak spot in our front lines, and they found it. And when they did, they made it a counterattack. The weather was against us. The skies were overcast. Our airplanes couldn't fly, and so therefore they made their attack. And they pushed our soldiers, all of them, they pushed us back. They created what we call a bulge in our front lines. So those of you who are conversant with history, you'll know that I'm talking now about the Battle of the Bulge. Well, it was into this battle that that we had our first commitment. We had to go up into Belgium. We had to go to a small town called Montelange. It was small, but in that town there was a bridge that had been destroyed completely by the enemy, and it was our responsibility to rebuild it, and we had to do this. Oh, yes, we had to, because you see, down the road into Luxembourg, there was another small town called Baston. And in Baston, there were soldiers. These were all American soldiers. They were trapped in that town. Their lives were in jeopardy. The enemy was all around them. So they needed help right away. Well, help was on the way. Tanks, guns, men, ammunition, all of that and more. We're going up, being sent up to Baston. Ah, but in order for them to get there, many of them would have to cross this bridge in Montelange. So you see, we had our work cut out for us. We had to rebuild that bridge, so we began to work. We worked night and day, in spite of the weather. We worked. In spite of the shelling of the 80, all the heavy guns that they had. In spite of all of that, in spite of the airplane that would come over daily, strafing machine gun bullets and trying to bomb the bridge. In spite of the landmines that were just about everywhere. We worked on the bridge. We finished that bridge. We finished it on time. And all of those resources, tanks, guns, men, ammunition, all of that went across the bridge. They went in, down into Luxembourg and into Baston, and they helped defeat the enemy. And that was one wonderful day, a glorious day in the lives of so many. What a wonderful experience that was for me. But my friends, we better remember, whenever we fight a war, so many of us pay a heavy price for glory. And I found out about that one day. One day I was standing alongside the road in the snow, and I was watching these trucks go by. These were grave registration trucks with the bodies of American soldiers piled high atop one another. And I stood there looking at that. I said to myself, Leon, what are you doing here? You could end up that way. What are you doing here? And then I asked the pivotal question that had been on my mind for such a long time. Leon, what are you fighting for? My friends, I asked that question because I remembered something. I remembered I couldn't get a drink of water at a public water fountain back home. They wouldn't let me have a meal in a restaurant back home. I couldn't get a seat on a bus back home. So what was I doing here? What was I fighting for? Look, I didn't have all the answers. I was just 19 years of age. But I was trying to put things together. I was trying to understand why my country is putting me out in harm's way to fight and maybe die, to preserve all those wonderful things that every American should enjoy. And yet at the same time, I was being told every day in so many different ways that I wasn't good enough to enjoy what I was fighting for. It was a terrible thing for me to have to wrestle with, but I did. But the war went on. My unit had to go with it. We went through the rest of France, Belgium, Luxembourg. We went into Germany. We followed the enemy all up into Germany. I saw places I'd never seen before, but I read about them in the books. Frankfurt, Cologne, Dusseldorf. One place was called Bad Kreuznach. Finally, Eisenach, and one day there was Nuremberg. The months had gone by. It was now 1945. I heard rumors that we were winning. We were defeating the enemy. Those were the rumors. But at that time, we received orders to go up into East Germany, to go up near a place called Weimar. So we drove our vehicles up there. We began to set up our camp. But right away, a lieutenant who was in the intelligence reconnaissance section for the battalion, and I was in that section, he came over to me and two others. He said, come with me. Well, we followed him. We got aboard the truck. But I leaned over and said, sir, where are we going? He responded by saying, we're going to a concentration camp. A what? I said to myself, a concentration camp? I didn't know anything about concentration camps. In all the training that they had given me, no one ever mentioned concentration camps. But on this day, in April in 1945, I was to have the shock of my life because I was going to walk through the gates of a concentration camp called Buchenwald. And you got to remember, and you got to believe me, I wasn't ready for that. I was totally unprepared for that kind of an experience, but I can never, ever forget the day. That spring day in April when I walked through those gates and I saw in front of me what I now call the walking dead. I saw human beings that had been beaten and starved and tortured and been denied everything, everything that would make life livable. There they stood in front of me. They were skin and bone, skeletal faces and deep-set eyes. Some of them were dressed in ragged pajama-type clothing. Others were naked. And I could see the sores on their bodies brought on by the malnutrition. One man held out his hands. His fingers had webbed together with the scabs that come from the sores brought on by the malnutrition. Oh, I said, I couldn't understand this. I'd seen death and dying. Yes, in the war, I saw death and dying, but nothing like this. And so they stood there and they started to stumble forward toward me. And as they did it, they began to speak in so many different languages. I couldn't understand any of it, so I began to step back, but I stopped. I said to myself, who are these people? What have they done that was so terrible? By anybody, why would they put them here in this condition? What? I didn't know. I was totally ignorant of what was going on. But gradually, my education continued. And there was a young man nearby. He was younger than the others and probably hadn't been in the camp too long. But the thing about it, he could speak English. Yes, he was very good at it. And so he began to tell us about Buchenwald. He said these people were Jews. They were gypsies. They were Jehovah's Witnesses. Some were Catholics. They were trade unionists, communists, homosexuals. Oh, they went on. He went on with a litany of groups that had been placed in the camp by the Nazis. And I submit to you this evening that in my judgment, the Nazis placed them all there because the Nazis were saying none were good enough. Therefore, they were not fit to live. They could be terminated, murdered. Wow, this was all beyond me, but I had to see more. I just knew I had to see more, so I walked about the camp, and the young man directed me to a barrack where the men would live, crowded in. I opened the door. I stepped across the threshold, and I closed the door, but I couldn't go any further. You see, the odor, the stench that comes from death and human waste, it was overpowering. It was awesome. I stood there holding my breath. Now, I knew I couldn't stay. I had to leave, but I turned. Before I could step away, I looked down, and there on the bottom bunk was a man, an emaciated, skin and bone human being. He was on a bed of filthy straw and rags, and he was trying so desperately to look up at me with that skeletal face and those deep-set eyes, but he was so weak. He had been starved for so long. It was a struggle for him trying to look up at me. But finally he did. He looked up at me. He said nothing, nor did I. And so then I opened the door, stepped across that threshold, and closed the door. The young man said, in another building you will find all parts of the human anatomy in jars of formaldehyde. Now this is where I discovered for the first time that the Nazis did medical experiments on human beings at Buchenwald, often without anesthesia. So I went in, and I saw all these jars filled with formaldehyde. I saw the place where they put their prisoners on for their operations. And then I saw how they operated and would take the part they wanted to keep and put it in the jar and put on a label. Well, I couldn't read German, no. But I could see. I saw it all. Eyes, ears, fingers, hearts, livers, kidneys, genitalia, all of it was there. Someone had done some artwork on a piece of human skin. Human skin. There was another lampshade in the room. It, too, was made out of human skin. Oh, my friends, that's enough to boggle your mind. But I saw that. I did. I had been in the camp maybe 4 to 5 hours. And in all that time, I didn't see any children. So I asked the man, "Where are the children?" He said, "The children were in the camp." Look, I didn't see them. But as I was leaving this building, I saw the clothing of the little children. The little children that didn't survive. Up against the wall, there were mounds of clothing. Caps, sweaters, stockings, shoes for little babies. There were the booties. I saw all of these things and more that belonged to the little children. But I never saw a child. Finally, I walked past the dead and the dying towards another building. And when I got close, I could see the dead body stacked up about 4 feet high, stretched about as wide as from where I'm standing to the first seat here. They were against the building called the crematorium. Well, I was inquisitive. I wanted to know. I went inside, and I saw 6 ovens. 6. I walked over, and I looked into one, and I saw what was left of someone who had been placed there. I saw the man's blackened skull. I saw the rib cage. I saw the bones and the ashes. The young man said, on a given day, the Nazis would come with a truck. They would remove the ashes from the ovens, and they would be transported to a farm. And they would spread those ashes all over the farmland as human fertilizer. The young man said they believed that in time that would enrich the soil. And then they could grow the food that would help them feed their army, the Wehrmacht. By this time, I had seen enough, more than I want to even talk about this evening with you. I was upset. My stomach was sick, and I just had to get away from that. But while I stood there, I realized that I was not the same anymore. Something had happened to me. Oh, I was this angry young soldier when I came into this camp. I didn't believe I had anything to fight for. I felt my country was bad to me because I was black, and I couldn't go here, and I couldn't go there, and I couldn't do this. But now I could see a bit more clearly. My blinders came off. My tunnel vision dissipated. I now understood that human suffering is not relegated to just me. No, that pain and suffering that I saw there could touch all of us, every one of us. Yes. So I was transformed. My whole outlook was different. I now realized that I did have something to fight for. There was a reason for me to be here on this day in April. Because not just for all the things you do when you fight, but because I was able to see and I could understand. That's the key. I could understand that things shouldn't be this way. And somehow, because I was wanting to get home so badly, I said, "Dear God, if you just let me get through all of this and get home, I'm going to try to do something. I'm going to try to be a better person." But I didn't know what I could do. I was just 20 years of age. My friends came back to the gate. We all got back aboard the truck, and we left that place in silence. No one said a word about what they saw that day at Buchenwald. The war ended in about 2 weeks after that. And then I was thinking I was going to go home. The Army had a different story. My unit was disbanded. I was sent down into the Philippines because we were going to invade Japan. I said, it never stops. But I was two days on the other side of the Panama Canal when our country dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I said, oh, maybe. On the first bomb, no. On the second, yes. The Japanese capitulated. And then I began my long wait to see what day I was going to go home. Finally, my day came, and I got aboard the ship. That ship took about 30-some days. They were still zigzagging and going home because they didn't know whether all the Japanese knew that the war was over. But I kept, every day I'd go up on the deck and look to see if I could see the coastline of my country. Every day was a disappointment. But one day I did go up. And on that day, I saw the shadow on the out on the horizon. And I saw a little smoke going up somewhere. Then I heard the music. And then I saw the dancing girls. Man, I knew I was home then. Oh, man. So that was a wonderful day. And believe it or not, it was my birthday. I went in, I was 18. I'm coming home, I'm 21. What a blessing. Two of my brothers in the Navy, two others in the Army, one in the Merchant Marine. We all were in and we all got home safely. So I was so overjoyed at that. But now I got to put my life together. What was I going to do? My parents always had a dream that one day I would go to college. Eh? Your parents had a dream too. And like my parents, they worked very hard to see that it would come to fruition. But I had doubts. In high school, I did all right. I got out. But I had a party time, you know. Hey, great day at school. But you pay for that later on. So I took a test down at Temple University. They would test all GIs if they wanted to come in, and they wanted to see if you had the ability to do college work. And here I go. I took a chance. I took the test. But the day before, I was in Boston visiting a friend. On my way back, I got near Philadelphia, and I remembered, oh, the test, I've got to take it. And I got off the train and ran up to, I made it in time. And I took the test, but I fell asleep halfway. You pay for a good time, don't you? And I woke up and I finished the test and I left and I kept wondering, did you make it, Leon? I don't know. I came back and the lady looked at my test grade and she looked at me and she said, young man, you have the possibility to do college work with effort, but not here at Temple University. Well, you know, sometimes you get so despondent, you say, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to give. No, I couldn't give up. My mom and dad wouldn't permit that. My father was a deep old Southern boy, and he said to me, son, keep your hand on the plow. Hold on. I said, Dad? I know he was giving me the message. Go on back. I didn't pass the test the first time. You know why? I didn't study. Now, I know all you young people know what I mean when I say that. I know everybody here took a test, maybe some of the older folks like me. You take a test, if you don't study, you're going to fail. Oh, I went back the second time, and you're supposed to make 80. I had studied this time. Maybe not enough, but I studied. I made 79.4. Close. That was all it was. Horseshoes and what? That's the thing. I don't know. I can't remember that one. But I went back again, and here went my dad. I said, Dad, I didn't make it. He just looked at me with that look he had. And he had a lot of witticisms from the side. He said, son, don't worry about the mule going blind. Just get on that wagon and hold the line. My dad was a smart man. He knew how to get over to me with all of those witticisms, but he was telling me, you don't give up. No, you don't back away. You stay in there, give it your best shot. So I studied night and day, really, night and day. I used to meet the milkman, he was coming. What are you doing up so early? I'm studying. He said, for what? I didn't tell him, but I was studying. I went down and I took the test. I aced it. I passed. And it made me an elementary school principal. Oh, man. I was a happy young man. You know, first time in my life that I felt I was going to do something special for my parents. But I had doubts. So I go out to this school in Pennsylvania called Westchester State Teachers College. You might have heard of it. You might be looking around for college. I recommend it. They may not recommend me, but I recommend it for you. But I went out there with my GI Bill in my hand. I'm going to be a college student. I go into the college office, and I said, I would like very much to become a student at your college, sir. He looked at me in a strange way, and he said, young man, you have to go back to your high school. High school? You've got to go back to your high school and tell them to send me a transcript. I said, what's a transcript? They said, that's the record of all the grades that you have earned while you were in high school. Oh, boy, I'm in trouble now. But I go back. I send that transcript. And then I looked at it when it came to me after I don't know how many days or weeks. And finally I opened it and I read it. And it said, Leon Bass, you have been accepted at Westchester State Teachers College as a student. And it gave the date, I said, hallelujah. Woo! I'm the happiest young man I'm the first one in my family to go to college. I was so proud and happy. But then my happiness disappeared. You see, I found out, because when I waited, I wanted to find out what dormitory I was going to live in. Who was going to be my roommate? This was an all-white school. There was very few blacks in the school. But I waited, and I found out that, no, I wasn't going to be living in the dormitory. I wasn't going to have a roommate. I couldn't eat in a dining hall. They kept saying something that they had been doing a long time ago, back near the Civil War, when they had this ruling, you're not good enough. Oh, my goodness. I could stand up here now and tell you I was angry, but that would be an understatement. I was more than angry. I was furious. Oh, I'd been reading books now. One of my favorite authors was James Baldwin. You might have heard of him. He wrote a book, and I read it, and one of his essays, and he said, to be black and in America is to be in a constant state of rage. Oh, I knew I was moving in that direction. But thank God I had wonderful parents, mom and dad. You know, when you're 18, you don't think they know very much. You get to be 21, they're the smartest people in town. Mom and dad set me down, and my dad said to me, son, I don't want you going out to that Westchester running your mouth, thinking you alone are going to change this world. He said, oh no, that's coming. That day's coming. To change, but you got to be ready for it. So your priority now is to go to college and get your education. And so I listened to my dad, and I swallowed my pride, and I told him I would go to college. I did. I went there. And I think after 2 years of being in the college, I decided one day I'd go up to the movie, the Warner Theater in Westchester. I went in there and I bought my ticket, and the usher pointed to some steps that led up to a balcony. Oh, he was telling me I wasn't good enough to sit down on the main floor. He should never have done that. I had enough. I just walked past him. I walked into that movie, and I sat down in the middle on the main floor. That was my protest. I was telling him and everybody else, look, I'm good enough. Well, you do things like that when you're upset, you know, a little angry. But then you start thinking, and your nerves take over. And my nerves were saying, Leon, you're not graduating college, you're going to jail. And those people would call the police in a minute. They would come. Oh, they had it right away. So I was nervous, but nobody came. Nobody. The movie ended, those people got up to leave. Well, so did I. But as I walked out, I looked to my left, I looked to my right, I thought the policeman was there waiting for me. But nobody had come. So I kept walking. And I walked outside of that movie. I walked up the highway towards the school, towards my where I was living. And with every step, I got taller and taller. I must have been 10 or 15 feet tall. You know why I felt that way? I felt that way because I had come face to face with evil. And I didn't become evil. And that was the most difficult thing I'd ever done in my young life. But what a joy when you think that you've done the right thing, even though it was very difficult. Graduated from Westchester in 1949. Got out in 3 years by going to summer school. That's a tip. I was in a hurry. I had enough of Westchester. I wanted to get out. And I got a teaching position in Philadelphia. I'm going to teach in an elementary school, a small black elementary school, separate but equal. That was still the law of the land. I had a fifth grade class. I had 49 students in my class. 40. Any of you young folks, you ever had 49 students in your class? Oh, boy, well, you missed a lot. That was the most difficult thing for me to do. They came to school every day. None of them would ever stay home. But, my friends, with all that difficulty and the fact that so many of them needed so much help, it was a joy working for their young people. And I had such a wonderful time, tired every day when I would get home. But there was a kind of tiredness I knew let me know that I was doing the right thing. I found my niche. I was going to be a teacher. So I worked hard at that school. But the one thing I couldn't seem to overcome is that the youngsters had a thing about violence. That was the way they solved their problems. You did so-and-so to me. I'll see you outside at recess. I'll see you outside on the way home. And they put this like they're going to black both your eyes. And I said, what are they doing? And then parents began to ask, tell me, I'm in school. These kids are four blocks away. We're fighting. You have to do something about that, Mr. Bass. Mate, what was I going to do? I can't follow all of them home. But I had to do something. So I didn't know which way to turn. And one day, the clarion voice of Dr. Martin Luther King came out of the Deep South. And he was saying on this radio, he was talking to me, and well, not me alone, but everybody. I thought he was talking to me. And he said, you can solve your problems. You can change things. But you don't have to be ugly. Do it without violence. Do it with love. I said, what are you talking about? Love all these people. He wanted me to love the people who are kicking me in my tuchus and who are beating my kids and want to burn my chains. He wants me to love them? He's out of his mind. But that man was persistent. He didn't stop. They tried to kill him, bombed his home, almost killed his children, stabbed him in New York. Yes, threw rocks and bricks because he was a leader. He wasn't a follower, but he believed in what he was talking about, and I couldn't fathom this. I'm trying to struggle and hold on to those values my parents had given me. Mom would always say, don't fight in school. She said, come home, run. Well, I wasn't much of a fighter, but I could run, and I would come home. But now, this is a different situation. I have all these young souls in front of me, and I have to come up with something. How can we change things? So I worked at that school for a number of years, doing everything I could. But then, one day, I joined with a group of people, 250,000. We went down to Washington with a march. We went down there to confront the Congress and the world and tell them that we were good enough and it was time for things to change. And we waited out in front of Lincoln Memorial on that hot summer day. We waited for this giant of a man to come out and speak to us. He walked out there on that platform, and I looked at him. He was a little guy. But he opened his mouth, and he began to speak, and I recognized him for the giant that he truly was. He said things I needed to hear, things my children back at school needed to hear. He spoke of loving, of caring, of nurturing, of compassion, of respecting everybody, no matter who and what they were. And then he talked to these young people about excellence in school. He said, you may go to school. Some of you want to be doctors and lawyers and engineers and teachers. Yes, yes. But some of you might not want to be. Maybe your job will be to sweep the streets. So be it. But if you sweep the streets, he said, I want you to sweep the streets like Beethoven wrote his music. You sweep the streets like Michelangelo painted those pictures. You sweep the streets like Shakespeare wrote his poetry. In other words, you be the best, no matter what it is that you do. Wow, I was mesmerized. And then he talked on and on, and he said, I have a dream. I have a dream that one day people will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream, he said. And I cried, yes. I stood there crying. All around me, people were crying, rich people, poor people, white people, black people, Jews, Gentiles, Catholics, Protestants, you name it, it's like a smorgasbord. All of them crying, crying unashamedly. What a beautiful day. I came back from that inspirational session with him, and I said, I'm going to try to do something more. And that's when I became principal and placed at an all-black elementary school. Yeah. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I had a white janitor. Okay. You caught that one, didn't you? Yes, it was true. I did. I had an all-black school, but I had a white, wonderful guy who was my custodian. And then they came to me one day after 2.5 years at that school, which I enjoyed so much and I learned so much. And they said, we're going to integrate the schools more fully, and we're going to send you to an all-white school. I said, where? They said, an all-white school. I was not ready for that yet, but I felt that Dr. King was trying to do that, bring people together so they could understand each other. So I said yes. So I had apprehension going up there, and I think they were a little worried too about my coming. But it's amazing what happens with proximity if you work with it. And we did. And that became a really wonderful joy. It was a love affair between me and all those teachers and all those young people. But then I went to Houston, Texas on a convention for elementary school principals. And we were sitting there waiting for the game to start. They flashed on the scoreboard out in center field. Dr. King had been shot. Oh, my God. And the people around me from that neighborhood began to say, good, good, we got that SOB. We're going to get the rest of those songs. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And then the flash again on the scoreboard. Dr. King was dead. Those people stood up and began to applaud. Oh, well, I left that place. I went back to my hotel. And like so many Americans, I watched the TV. And I saw what was happening in the big cities all across this country. Burning, looting, killing. Everything that was diametrically opposite from Dr. King's philosophy. People were in desperation. I thought maybe they were desperate because they felt they had lost their dream because they had lost the dreamer. That wasn't true, but that's the way they perceived it. Well, it took me 2 or 3 months to get myself together. And then I got a letter from a telephone call from the superintendent of schools. He said, Leon, come to my office. Well, I go down. And he said to me, I have a high school, sir, that needs a principal. I thought about you. Would you be willing to provide the leadership that that school needs? Right away, I became suspicious. He's offering me a high school when I know so many of my white friends that were waiting for one. And I said, I bet it's bankrupt. But no, he said, I said, sir, what's the name? He said, it's the Benjamin Franklin High School. He was talking about the toughest school in the city of Philadelphia. Toughest in the country in 1968. There were no girls in this school. No. No, these were all young men. Bad dudes, too. I mean, bad young men. Excuse my rhythm talk. I get that way once in a while. But they were bad when I went to school. You see, we used to play football against them. How many? Hey, babe. Always happens. Anyway, they were tough because we played football, and they used to cheer and say, if you win the game, we're going to win the fight. And I used to leave early. I never waited. To make it a long story short, I stayed at that school trying to bring order. Very difficult school. But they taught me a lot. Yes, they were tough, but they needed a lot, and they wanted a lot. And they wanted somebody who would hang tough with them and help them. And that's what I tried to do. I tried to give them love. Love means sit down and shut up, keep quiet. But you can't do that until you pay your dues. When they know you're fair and you're real, you're not a $3 bill, you're not a counterfeit, yeah, they'll listen, but you got to pay your dues. I paid mine. And then I had to make sure the school was what it's supposed to be. And I wouldn't permit any of this profanity, none of this fighting. Oh, I had to go to court so many times because I locked them up. I was for real. I love you, baby, but you come here with a gun, I'm going to send you to jail. But I love you, and they couldn't understand that. I guess they thought I was crazy. But I felt that that was the thing I had to convey to my teachers and as well as to my students. And one day as I walked around the school, I saw this big guy behind me. I didn't know who he was, but I asked them in the office, I said, who's this big fellow following me? They said to me, that's your bodyguard. Now I knew where I was. But no, I went there. But one day while I was there, I went to a class because I heard the noise. I looked into the class. Yeah, 5 minutes. You got to negotiate. Right? I went into a class. There was a lady there. She was trying to talk to these young men. They were very tough and not listening. They were rude. And I found out she wasn't a teacher. She was a visitor. She was a survivor. She had survived survived a camp, one of the worst camps in Europe at the time. It was Auschwitz. And she'd come to speak to these young men. She wanted to share her pain, and they weren't listening. So I stepped right up front. All right, fellas, hold it. Cool it. Listen. What the lady is saying is true. I know it is because I was there. I saw it. They got quiet. She shared her pain. And when it was all over, they shook her hand. They looked at the numbers on her arm that the Nazis placed for identification purposes. They walked out of that classroom in silence. And that has never happened with these young men. And I knew because she came up to me, tears in her eyes, and said, young man, "You've got something to say." She had talked to the teacher about me. She said, "You have something to say. You should tell people what happened to you in the Deep South. You should tell them about what you saw at Buchenwald." This was 1971. I've been speaking ever since. I traveled all over this country, Canada, Ireland, all over to the Bermuda and places like that. I go everywhere. I want to speak to everybody, or young, old, white, black, doesn't matter. Is it easy? No. Is it a joy? Yes. But everybody is not in love with you when you go out to effectuate a change. You try to make a change, you better be ready, because you're going to have pain that you never created. No. So you have to answer the question. The question is this: will you dare? Will you dare to stand up and speak out for people who are less fortunate than you? Somebody's being bullying. Will you be able to stand up in the playground and say, "Hey, Henry, you're my best friend, but you don't do that"? That takes courage. When the neighbors say, "Oh, look at the people living across the street, they're going to change the neighborhood." You say, "Wait, Mary, you're my friend. We play bridge together. But that talk is not right." Well, they might turn to you and say, "Well, if you're not right, we're not coming back here anymore." So what you do, you have to answer this question. Is the price too high? Is the price too high to stand up for what you believe is right? I don't think it is. But if you dare to be a Daniel, if you dare to go into the den of evil and stand up for somebody who needs your support, your love, what a wonderful joy you have. Oh, yes, you have to think about it, because the price may be the loss of a job, the loss of a friend, maybe some other kind of loss. I don't know. Where do you stand? This is a time where we're talking about understanding. Look in the mirror. Make an assessment. Who am I? Where am I? What am I doing? Then you do that. If you do, then I want you to remember the words of my great writer, James Baldwin, who said, "Either we love one another, either we hold to one another, or the sea will engulf us and all of the lights will go out." You and I, we have an awesome responsibility. We must keep the light shining. Thank you for listening. Thank you very much.
Strange way. I was negotiating with people in Vancouver to come and speak at their college. And we got everything going, and I was saying, "Yes, I'm going to be there." When a fellow said, wait a minute, there's somebody here that knows you. I said, "I don't know anybody in Vancouver." And he put him on the phone, Robbie Waisman. And Robbie said, "I know you." I said, "No, I don't know you." And he kept saying, "You were my Messiah. You were my liberator. Oh, God. He was so emotional. I said, "Wait a minute. This has got to be up something. All these years, 1945, and he's telling me he remembered me. I don't remember him. I saw all of these people. I didn't."
And it's because of your incident with this lady that came to your school.
Yes.
That the B'nai B'rith published this in a B'nai B'rith magazine. And I saw his picture as a soldier, and this is how I recognized him.
Oh.
Okay.
That was the
link. And I said, "That's the soldier that I was trying to communicate with and touch." And there was also another soldier that was a photographer. His name was Scott. I didn't know his name or anything. And, of course, we thought that these soldiers that came in to liberate, particularly the black soldiers, that this is a mirage, it's not happening, these are not real. And this is the reason I wanted to touch him, to make sure that he was real. The same thing with the jeeps that were coming in. Are these actually real? And another incident that happened is that one of the soldiers began to speak in Yiddish, and he says, "I am a rabbi." And again, that also convinced me that it's not happening, because a rabbi in a uniform, he doesn't have a big hat and black trousers and a black coat.
And a beard.
And a beard. And so nothing seemed real. And it's just wonderful. And to be again reunited with him, because up to that point, I did not speak about my experiences. But I had promised to one of the elders in the dark and one of the in the camp, "Hey, kid, if you survive, remember, tell the world what you have witnessed." Because there was no instant television and so on. Like we know today, if something happens in one of the countries, we know immediately. And so by meeting Leon, and also by experiencing, there was a teacher in Eckville, Alberta, in Canada, who was teaching his young students that the Holocaust was a myth, it didn't happen. And so I remembered the promise I made, and I thought it was time for me to contribute back. And when I do this on behalf of the 1.5 million Jewish children that weren't as lucky as I was. I represent 7% of Jewish children that survived. If the war had lasted another 6 months, I wouldn't be here. Wasn't I supposed to answer questions?
Yeah.
Thank you.
That was good.
Oh, question.
Good evening. My name is Renat Chase, and I'm originally from Israel. I have a question to both of you. Did either one of you ever travel to Israel, to Yad Vashem?
Have any of us traveled to?
Did either of you ever travel to Israel?
No.
To Yad Vashem?
Oh, yes. We had a reunion day in the year 2000, and the boys of Buchenwald were filmed in there. And we, of course, were at Yad Vashem. And in fact, I have contributed various items to Yad Vashem.
Well, I never made it to Israel. It's been on my agenda for a long time. And every time I got an invitation, I was at another commitment. And just recently, he's gone on the March of the Living. We were supposed to go.
Leon was supposed to come with me, but
let's be honest, I can't walk too well.
There's
a lot of walking
to be done. So, but I'm not giving up on you.
No. I'm going to make that trip. You know, and I want to go to Israel to see Yad Vashem, but I've been 4 or 5 times to the museum in Washington, D.C., and spoken there so many times. And, yeah, I'm trying to keep my hand in. So you can look for me. I'll be there.
Yeah,
okay.
Good question. Thank
you. Is there one up there on the balcony, please?
Viktor Frankl had mentioned that in his camp, when it came to the guards and the prisoners, you would think that there'd be a clear line between good and evil, but there wasn't. And did you have the same experience where you witnessed any form of decency in any of the German guards?
Yes,
that,
I
that
did.
Helped the prisoners?
Yes. There was one, before arriving to Buchenwald, we were in a place called Pszczetbosz, and we were digging anti-tank ditches. And we worked in pairs. And the man that I was working with had enough of it all. And he threw his shovel down and turned to me and he says, "It's all yours, kid." And he walked away. And one of the SS guard asked him to stop, and he didn't. And he took his rifle from his shoulder and shot him. And everybody started working that much faster because usually it didn't stop with one killing. I felt his rifle, his butt, on my shoulder. And I looked up and he motioned me to follow him. And I was sure that he didn't want me to fall into the to the ditch, and he's going to kill me somewhere else. And as I was walking with him, he had a knapsack close by. He bent down, not a word, pulled out an apple and gave it to me and screamed at me to get back to work. A spark of decency. Maybe he was sorry that he just killed somebody, and his redemption wasn't letting me live and giving me an apple. You can take it in those ways, but I look upon it as one of the kind of things. And I have some other things, but I just have very quickly another incident. When we had enough munitions loaded on a wagon, I was sent to the office to get a bill of lading. And there was a blonde lady who never spoke to me, wasn't allowed to speak to me. I don't know if she was German or Polish. She was blonde, but she had, you could see the tenderness in her eyes, the way she looked at me. But one day, she gave me the bill of lading, and she screamed at me, "Rouse!" and get in some other things. And I remember going out with the bill of lading, thinking, "You were so kind. Wow, why are we all of a sudden so bitchy?" And lo and behold, I come out, and I feel that there's something underneath the bill of lading. And I open it, and it was two pieces of bread, butter, and jam. That sustained me for a week. Now, she risked her life to do this and mine, but I didn't care. I would do it all over again. In fact, she kept repeating it several times. Now, I don't know her name, but if I did, I would find and propose her name to be honored at Yad Vashem as a righteous among the nation, because what she did was huge. Mm-hmm. You know, she might have saved my life, you know, from hunger. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you reminded me of this, because to show you that in the midst of all these horrors, there was a spark of humanity.
I think these stories of hope and decency and faith are a wonderful way to end our evening. Thank you for sharing everything with us tonight.
You've been listening to a special lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies and the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. We've heard the second part of a presentation by Robbie Weissman, a survivor of the Buchenwald concentration camp, an educator, and past president of the Vancouver Center for Holocaust Remembrance and Education, and Leon Bass, World War II veteran and member of the 183rd Engineer Combat Battalion, a unit that liberated Buchenwald, and author of Good Enough, One Man's Memoir on the Price of the Dream. Their topic was A Story of Survival and Liberation. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 6, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Kugler, director of the Center for Faith Studies, and Beth Selden-Doton, executive director of the Institute for Holocaust Education, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.